Welcome to the Triple Top Line Podcast. This is the first podcast where you can learn how your business can create a positive impact on people, the planet, and profit. Here we bring the most brilliant minds from the startup and sustainability worlds to share their opinions and ideas around the topic. I'm Alex, co-founder at Catalyst Adventures, and I'll be here as the host on the show. The future is Triple Top Line.
So today in the studio, I have the pleasure of being joined by Erica Neve. And Erica is a regenerative superhero. Yeah, superhero in the regenerative world and looking to the future with some great ideas for different business models and different ways of tackling some of the grand challenges that we have. So Erica, a very warm welcome. Maybe you can say a few words about yourself and what you do. I know you're a person with many, many different hats. You wear many different hats. You have lots of different roles. Someone who's also passionate about variety. So please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you, Alex. And thank you for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation we're going to have together. So I suppose my whole passion point is around helping businesses and individuals transform and seeing that process and supporting that process as it happens. And doing it from a real human-centric approach, so understanding how and why someone may want to change and supporting them to go through that change, even when it's scary, because change is scary for humans humans don't necessarily want to do it. So finding those conditions that are honest and safe for people to go through that change and share how they're feeling about it. And historically, that has been sort of across different types of businesses, from the retail banking sector to the private to the third sector in the UK to all sorts of different sectors. But now I'm working much more in supporting businesses that really want to address the climate emergency and helping climate nonprofits think about how they can scale their impact, but not just as individual nonprofits, as a group of nonprofits, and not just within a particular stream of the climate emergency and tackling that, but across the climate community. So it's a really exciting period to be in, and I hope together we're able to do.
I mean, first of all, I'm fascinated that you know, you have this broad range of experience, as you said, from the private sector to the NGO sector. But most of all, it's this sense of this inner transformation, this sense of engaging and changing habits and moving forward to building a more resilient planet. So let's kick off with ourselves. Let's start off with a little icebreaker. In terms of sustainable habits that we'd like to break and to develop this year. So if there's one of each, what would you say that they are for you personally?
Well, unsustainable habit that I want to break, or maybe it's what I'm going to do that will hopefully drive a little bit more impact than some of the other things I could do. I am reviewing all of my savings and investments, all my pensions, because as I've delved deeper, as I've become more knowledgeable, I realised that things that I thought were invested aligned to my values and my sustainable goals, they weren't. They just looked like they were. They're in a portfolio that looked like it was ethical, but there were certain things in it which weren't. So I'm speaking with my the person that helps me, an independent financial advisor in the UK, and we're going through those things. And quite sometimes it's really difficult because they want to do the best by me and give me the best return on investment so I can retire when I want to. And what I'm pushing back at them is saying, yeah, the best for me is by making this investment the most ethical and sustainable possible. It's not me as an individual and my particular return on it. And it's really interesting. It's helping them change their mindset as well. So that's the one thing. And change all my banks, because I still have a business bank account that I don't think is probably in the best place. And what I have learned is those are one of the quickest and most impactful things you can do as an individual. Think about your pensions, savings, investing, and your bank.
Really interesting one that you're reflecting on that. My mum is someone who's really inspired me on this journey, from someone who was, you know, in the early 1980s, really into organic food and trying to get away, you know, sort of part of the anti-plastic movement and so on. And she did change her banks back in those days, and this was exactly this same essence of, you know, I don't want to be, you know, banking with someone who is financing nuclear weapons, let's say, or you know, doing other, you know, whether it's tobacco or big oil and so on. So it's really really good, you know, a great journey to be on. Okay, so that's one habit to break, and then what about something to develop this year?
So I have been experimenting with eating a nearly entirely plant-based diet, so vegetarian and vegan, but then I realized I could still actually enjoy meat if I wanted to, but I needed to think about it and really make a decision about it. So for example, maybe locally small sustainable farming practices, maybe not eating beef, or for example in the UK we have quite a problem with deer, so they're culled. Well, how about the meat from those culled deer that need to be culled because of the damage they do environmentally is then eaten and not wasted? So what I'm going to do is think about how I can eat sustainably, but make my decision based on more than just a black and white decision of not eating meat completely.
Super. So that's something that really, really connects with me. I've developed a gluten intolerance over the years. So I guess, you know, our food systems have changed as well as my body changing over time. You know, obviously I ate loads and loads of bread as a teenager and in my 20s. And I think there's a fantastic selection now of, you know, plant-based food, which is actually, you know, tastes so good. That we have that supply available. So that inspires me to want to sort of make more of that this year as well. So thanks for sharing that.
No problem.
So let's jump into a little bit more about your background and your sort of, you know, what historically has shaped your thinking. Yeah, what is it that's brought you to the journey that you're on now?
So I suppose the journey where I focus, even though I work across all different types of sectors, even now, it is around, like you said, individual transformation and individual behavioural change. And if I loop back to where it all began, it sounds quite disconnected, but it's not at all. So when I really started looking at motivation, individual and group motivation, how groups work together, things like that, is when I ended up in London for the first time. As a working adult, I did study at university in London, and I got a job at a record label, and it was an urban British record label. And as part of that job, we developed a training arm because we realized the talent pipeline coming through had low levels of maths and English and ICT. And that impacted on their success as artists or working in the music industry. So I went to set up the training arm for the record label. The training arm, at that time, the majority of the people coming through the record label were from gangs. And part of our process was to help them leave gangs so they could re-enter society, they could work, they could earn money, they could earn a living, they could become an artist, they could be put in front of the media from a completely cynical business perspective. And for me, it was for a purpose-driven perspective. And as our program grew, we actually then had a whole academy. And now my old boss has a whole school of not just people that wanted to be artists. But as it became bigger and through the doors every day, people from all sorts of different gangs in London came, we needed to find ways to motivate and keep motivating these young people. So we tried all sorts of things. And one of the things which worked really, really well was we tested a stock exchange, so they had stocks and shares in each other, because we needed to find a way to encourage positive behavior for individual and group transformation. And through this, we realized and were able to see that people started peer learning from each other. They peer supported each other. And we ended up being able to get these groups of young people from less than 5% attendance at school typically to 95% attendance to our programs. And all of them gained qualifications and GCSEs. So really looked at this individual and group transformation. I then realized, actually, the techniques that I'd used with gang members, and specifically when we had gang leaders on our courses, were the same techniques that we could learn, apply, and provide individuals in organizations, including C-suite and senior members. I don't think it's that controversial that actually sometimes there's not much difference between someone embedded in, say, gangs, maybe criminal activities, and very, very influential, powerful people. There's something that they need to be able to do to have those characteristics. So I then transferred my what I'd learnt working with gangs and helping them re-enter society and be part of society, that I could do that in corporate settings, in schools, in nonprofits, and went on from there.
I mean, it sounds like an incredibly rewarding experience that you've gone through and seeing that, and that really, you know, clearly speaks to me in terms of you being this incredible catalyst who's taken these individuals, taken these groups, and had this incredible change. And then there's also this sense of the transferability of the skill set. Yes. You know, so when you're saying, you know, it doesn't seem very joined up when you look at it, but when you actually think about the skills and the competencies and the passion that you're able to bring into your work, this really speaks. Really speaks a lot.
Yeah, it certainly has. And as I said, it's transferability, not just the transferability of what I was doing, but actually it was looking at the individuals as a whole person, not as a student, not as a gang member, not as a CEO, not as an employee in a bank branch, or any of those things. It's looking at somebody at the whole person and the attributes or characteristics that will enable them to remain successfully and happily confident and hopeful, actually, part of society. And those kind of things are transferable in any job or any role. It's adaptability, it's problem solving, it's all those kind of things. And those are the very things we need now with the climate emergency.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could have another whole session just on the similarities of gang leaders and CEOs and C-suites, but we can move on from that one. So that's obviously been sort of the formative part of your career and your background. What about some of the things that you're working on right now? What are the exciting things that are, yeah?
There's a couple of really exciting things. One of them that I'll briefly speak to is supporting an organisation called SUBAK, which takes its name actually from an Indonesian water system. It's worth looking up afterwards. And SUBAK is the world's first accelerator for nonprofits. For climate nonprofits, and it's also a data cooperative. And my role is to support them to think about how you create a community and a movement of those nonprofits going through the accelerator, and actually what those nonprofits need and require to scale and scale at impact. So this is about nonprofits not just acting as an individual nonprofit, it's scaling at impact together, and the levers that they're best suited as organizations individually and as a group to pull to drive that impact at scale. So that's one project.
So let me just jump in there quickly. Let's just check we've got the same understanding, and for the audience as well, in terms of what is an accelerator. So just, if you could just sort of talk us through in simple terms, what does an accelerator do?
So an accelerator in this case is a program that is typically 9 months long. Our program will have three parts. The first part will be 3 months long. And it will involve four pillars of learning, which is practical learning or practical support. Sometimes it's not learning, it's support to help an organization be able to develop on its product or service or solution. And it might be support like hiring new team members, managing accounts, things like that. So there's support and learning around business operations. their support and learning in this case around how the policy drivers, if you want to change policy with your nonprofit climate organization, support and learning around marketing and awareness and authority building, and support and learning about gaining scaling your business, how to scale your business, how to go from a small business that's been operating for 2 or 3 years to a not necessarily a large business with many employees, but a business that can scale its product or service that it provides. And then lastly, the aim of the accelerator is to de-risk the business, so maybe all of those things and maybe some other things, the nonprofit, for investment at the end of the accelerator program. So the purpose is you get them to a point where they are then ready for investment, and whoever's investing them, in this case we're looking at impact investors, is able to trust that that investment, that business has been de-risked for them.
Super. Really, really, I think great explanation. Thanks for that. So I'm imagining as well, you know, with SUBAC that these NGOs are coming in, they have maybe a local solution, something that's really targeted to fulfilling a local need. And then you're helping them to make that as a much wider application, possibly even across borders to other communities, much more wide, and then make it sort of really attractive on the investment side as well. And I think this is our understanding as well with Triple Top Line, in terms of helping these businesses or even organizations to be then financially self-sustainable, to be able to have a much wider impact. So this is sounds really, really super. Yeah.
I think the other aspect that is really important with this solution is the data cooperative. So the data cooperative runs in parallel to the accelerator, and to be on the accelerator, or even a fellow, you can be an individual, and you're supported financially. That's the other point we didn't draw upon, but typically accelerators support you financially as well. So this accelerator provides around £90,000 to £100,000 worth of grant for a business and £10,000 for a fellow, an individual. But one of the aspects of finding the right nonprofits to accelerate is their data capabilities or the data that they will have. And the idea is that it's about data sharing and different data sets, and looking at what those different data sets together tell us about the climate emergency and other solutions that we can do, because it's such a complex set of data that we need to consider. And quite often we don't have access to the data that we need. This is about creating a cooperative.
Super. And then I think if we could make this concrete in terms of an example for the audience as well, so they can really connect with the type of NGO then that actually comes onto that accelerator. What is it that they do? What sort of problem do they solve in society?
Typically, they're trying to do two things. They're trying to create a product or service that changes mass consumer behavior, so it'll be something direct to consumer. So one of the organizations last year was a car conversion organization, so converting cars to electric. They want to do two things: get more people buying cars, and then their policy change and their other campaigning is around electric car charging points. Actually, what you do after electric cars, that is just kind of a stopgap type thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they want to get the public to use electric cars instead, convert their existing cars to electric, drive policy change, and make it practically able for the individual to have an electric car. So that's one example. And then on the other side, it's about policy influence. So there is some energy companies that are typically, one's called Ember, that are looking at policy level change around energy, how energy is served in the UK and beyond. And what they're doing is doing lots of research around data sets from, say, power stations in the UK and stuff like that. So it gives them access to work with those different data sets and then suggest policy level changes.
I think what you're talking about there as well is really illustrative of, you know, complex systems thinking, when you're working with so many different levers and buttons and individuals and groups and government state actors, the whole range. This is really, really incredible. So Yeah, wonderful, wonderful to hear this. Really, really nice illustrations. But that was only about Subak. So yeah, let's hear about some of the other things that you're working on as well.
The next project, which I'm super excited about, which is going to be piloted in the first quarter of this year, is around mass behavioral change and individual transformation. It's called 50 Minutes for Our Future, and it's based around the concept that you can change behavior by normalizing climate education and bringing it into your business as usual. And one of the ways you can do this is literally put it inside businesses and corporates. And this is designed around 50 minutes of climate education, designed by experts, but really importantly, delivered by a peer who is not an expert, but seen as somebody who can be trusted and somebody who has some kind of social capital. And then that is delivered alongside a live data dashboard that can show an individual a sense of progress, but also an organization a sense of collective progress. So, you know, number of sessions taken, but at an individual level, how they're doing along their transformation around a set of attributes. So what we're designing is a taxonomy of attributes that you use to assess the progress, which are around the mindsets, skill sets, and behaviors required to be confident and competent and hopeful about our future, and then be able to make decisions. So this isn't about complete climate literacy, because that's not going to happen. So things we knew 5 years ago, we know aren't right now. It's about having a framework and confidence to consider and make decisions and know what questions to ask to help you make those decisions. The other element of this program is honesty. It's about creating a space for honesty and being able to share what you don't know, you don't understand, or even what you feel guilty about or what you feel really proud about. And that's really important. So it's about normalizing conversations. It's about actually tracking at first some of the conversations happening and how many conversations are happening, and creating that confidence and competence. So it's a bit like thinking about, I don't know if you've ever used something like a fitness app like Fitbit or Strava or anything like that. It's a bit like combining the metrics that something like that uses to motivate an individual, put you in cohorts of people similar to yourselves, and then a peer-led learning program, a bit like programs that you may have been part of in the past, or you may have seen being successful. So like a globally successful peer-led change program is, off the top of my head, something like Weight Watchers. That's small group-led, peer-led programs where you share personal weight data and group weight data with each other. So it works like that. And the idea, it's regular. It builds a behavior. You're supported to build a behavior. You feel safe developing that behavior. You feel safe if you fail to talk about it, and you have the data to measure your progress. So that's what I'm really excited about. It's going to be trialed in a corporate. Obviously, we're going to have control groups. We're also going to test it against standard self-serve, off-the-shelf e-learning. And a control group that's doing absolutely nothing. So this assessment that we're developing with this taxonomy of attributes, we will assess the group going through the peer-led 15 minutes of learning with tangible next steps and actions they can choose to take from the e-learning cohort of people that are taking an e-learning course in sustainability and decision making, and a control group doing nothing. So we're really excited to what will come out of the back of that.
I mean, it sounds rigorous, but also really, really exciting. I think for me personally, this sense of having this instant feedback on how I'm doing and how I'm progressing is so important. So, you know, if I imagine from what you're saying, you know, even if it was me sort of measuring my footsteps and my actual physical activity every day, that's already something that I can, you know, get a real-time readout from my phone or an app. And feel that change and get a sense of that change. And then when I'm participating with colleagues or friends in sort of these group challenges, this sounds like a really powerful way of changing behavior.
Yeah. There's a large element of community and why we as humans want to be part of a community, and also what motivates us. So for some people, like you said, it's seeing your step count go up or a scoreboard or something like that. But for other people, it's a sense of belonging. So the design of this program will really look at those motivations and also how important autonomy is and a sense of purpose to humans. So giving people that autonomy and that sense of purpose, but the framework to be able to confidently ask questions, because that's really what people need to be able to do, because they cannot become completely climate literate. It's ludicrous.
Totally. Do you want to say anything in terms of, you know, where to look out for this program, or where to get more information, like a website or something?
So the project is very much in pilot and prototype, and we've got some really great partners that we're working with. So I think what we will be doing is sharing some blogs, sharing some literature out there, and sharing what we've learned, because it's very much about, if we can prove this and we believe it does work, because we've seen it work in other spheres like digital transformation, other types of change programs, and we've got a body of evidence, we want to scale this across other organizations. So I think the first port of call is keep a watch out. We'll share it with you all. That any updates, any blogs, any information, any microsites that we create over the next couple of months. And I'm sure that we'll want to talk to other people, maybe do little tests with other organizations.
Super. And then just one more question that springs to mind in terms of, you were talking about, you know, someone with social capital coming in and talking to a group. I mean, I don't necessarily need a name, but just if you could give an example of a person who would come in and one of the topics that they personally would talk about in order to influence that group.
Well, there's two ways, actually, you can have social capital. And in a peer-led setting, there is proof that you have over 30% more engagement and delivery of outcomes when you have peer-led learning environments. And even if that peer is a stranger, it's the fact it's a peer, so I have some kind of capital in like the network, so it's a stranger that they work with, a stranger that is part of a group they belong to, that type of thing. So first of all, when you pick somebody who's going to come in and talk about something and share something, the characteristics of that person, you look at things around problem solving, natural problem solver. So for example, when I've done this type of intervention with someone working in the retail sector, typically those people in customer service are awesome. They have the capability to connect with people. They want to solve problems, those type of things. So that's one type of person with social capital. And then the other type of person I've seen in organizations like Aim High, which is a climate education organization, they work with really great climate communicators. So people that bring the human stories into the narrative of sharing something. They don't just go very scientific, very fact-based. And actually they tend to move away from the disaster, the anything that stuff that can cause anxiety, but they don't hide it. They talk about it in a different way. And actually you can then look at people who are used to engaging and reading audiences really well. So maybe you're a science communicator already, a science journalist already, but other people that can deliver content that changes people's behavior includes people like comedians, includes people like artists, those type of people, especially comedians, actually those type of people that have to walk into a room, read an audience, and know how to work with them very quickly, and take them on a journey that they all feel part of and enjoy, or it changed their behavior, whatever it might be. And another group of people that can do this very well, and I've used this in behavioral change programs, are magicians. And the reason why magicians do it is because the magicians need to make the impossible possible. And when you're doing things that are hard, like thinking about the climate emergency and not being overwhelmed about it, or changing something very radical like having to lose a great deal of weight or a change program for an organization, the techniques that somebody like a magician uses is the same. It's about helping people believe the impossible is possible.
That reminds me back to when we met and having that session with a magician as well. That was really something that's stuck with me. So if we take that a little bit further then, and thinking about, I'm trying to link this back to what you were saying about anything from, you know, footsteps or walking, or, you know, losing weight and actually seeing that immediate impact. Let's touch a bit more now on then on this personal transformation. So a lot of people that I speak to, you know, feel this sense of powerlessness. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's such a huge topic. It's so difficult when we've sort of got this asteroid, you know, hurtling towards Earth, and you get the connection with the film. But just thinking about, you know, how important is just taking that very small first step in an individual's journey?
I think it's not actually as important as regular conversations. That's why I said earlier, normalizing conversations, normalizing climate education. I think once you're talking about it, once it becomes part of your everyday, your business as usual, you are able to see the steps you can take immediately and the steps that other people are taking, and you reach out. It's a bit like, what's happening here, I see a little bit like how people don't talk about money. And we're actually seeing a global shift to people talking about lots of the things we don't talk about. So culturally in Britain, you never share how much you earn. You don't talk about money in your savings. It's considered uncouth and it's this big dark art. Well, actually, the sort of sense of fear, uncertainty, oh, it's a bit, you know, it's a little bit similar to this, the climate emergency, thinking in new, actually taking that jump of, this is a whole new way of thinking, it's a whole new way of acting. So it's normalizing speaking about it, it's normalizing being honest, and it's normalizing uncertainty, and also surrendering to the process of uncertainty. And knowing that everybody's in the same boat. This is a human-wide, worldwide challenge. So I think that's it. And I think what you can do, and what education can do, is scaffold an individual's journey, and that's where the little steps happen. So provide a level of understanding the concepts, but recognize it's complex, but then provide a suite of curated actions people can take and choose from. So take people on a journey and recognize where they're starting from, both emotionally and knowledge based, and give them curated content or the ability to create content, because that's the other challenge as well. There's so much out there that for the everyday person, it's easy to feel hopeless. It's easy to decide not to do anything, because you do something and then quite often you can read somewhere else, or that thing wasn't good enough, or it wasn't right. So yes, I think it's about curation, presenting information, giving people options, but scaffolding with, first of all, understanding of the key concepts, but then a framework to ask questions and make decisions by.
You touched on a lot of really interesting points there. One that's really sticks in my mind is this sense of, you know, open and honest conversations about it, and talking about these either habits, bad habits that we have. So for me, we had a change in public policy here where people were given 10 cents back on every bottle or can that they returned to a machine. And this for me was actually a really powerful trigger of really starting to take care of the plastic in the home, and seeing that, you know, you can collect a bag and go in and get, you know, €3 back or whatever it was. It was a really powerful starting point, and yeah, for me, I think that was, you know, a piece of the scaffold that's happened in the last couple of years. So this sense of, I think we've talked here quite a lot about, you know, it's behavioral change, it's individual behavioral change at an individual level. You've talked about a lot of the factors there. If we can then link to one of my other sort of favorite topics, which is this sense of, you know, being a human being and a human doing. I think you've talked quite a bit now about the self-awareness that needs to come, or, you know, and raising around you. I mean, it's a bit of a left field question, but you know, what is this balance of being and doing? Is that even the right question?
I almost say it's like the transition that we all need to take. So I was thinking about it, and maybe, you know, being is around this I think it's maybe about being empathetic, loved based, in service of everybody, not just myself. And that's actually not what we are really like in the Western world. It's me, 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 I, success, success, I've done this, goal setting, completing goal, and not intention setting. And maybe be where we need to move into is intention setting and uncertainty within that intention setting. And also recognizing being in service of all of others of the world as opposed to just ourselves, and the benefit of that, because there's so much research on human happiness and human sense of purpose when you're kind to other people and you do things for other people, and bringing that back into it. And also this, I suppose, goes into things like bioleadership, biomimicry, nature, and seeing how nature works when it's not interfered with by humans in unison with each other as a network. There's a book behind me on my shelf called Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Changes Our Minds and Shapes Our Futures, which is all about mycelium networks. And I think that's, we've become so detached from being part of the world, and having an impact on it, and it's having an impact on us, that we need to reconnect with that, and also not have to feel or think we're the most powerful thing in the room, or the powerful animal or the powerful being on the planet, because we really aren't. So maybe that's something about it. But then maybe there's one other point I think we could go back to that I didn't kind of talk about, but you alluded to, with 10 cents back on a bottle. There's also conditions that we can create to move people into being, into in service of others, into in service of everybody. And that's using nudges and behavioral science, whether it's at policy level, government level, or institution level, or family level. I mean, maybe at family level, people might call it, they might even go into thinking about bribery and things like that, but you can set the conditions. Bribery isn't behavioral nudges or behavioral science, but you can move around that to the conditions of, you know, a family working together, and the reward of the family working together, the time you've got together and things like that. And I think that's what we need to think about. What are the nudges and the behavioral science techniques we can use to encourage behaviors? Because once somebody's done it once, and then they do it again and then again and again, they develop the habit, the ritual, the behavior. And that maybe move us into this intention, this way of setting intentions rather than goals. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I really take away from that this sense of, you know, stepping back from just the doing and you know, focusing on the intention, on the being, and that very much is the connection there with that. So yeah, thanks for sharing those thoughts. So we've talked, you know, a lot about then the individual, you know, also with groups moving beyond the individual. You've talked about quite a few of the organizations, both on the NGO side and some organizations, business organizations as well. What about, I think one of the really interesting topics for me now is employee engagement. So we're seeing this, you know, global talent shortage. It's really becoming incredibly difficult to find, you know, good people, talented people. You've already talked us through about what happens when you take people with very raw talent and develop them through. But what are you seeing in organizations about how companies are engaging their employees and keeping them and helping them to drive change as a wider organization?
I'm seeing I'm really hopeful as I'm seeing new business leaders coming through with their new businesses and operating in a way that I feel does act much more like nature, like an ecosystem, collaborative, communicating, sharing. And that's really exciting me. And an example of that is actually some fintechs. So fintechs and retail banking and financial services, and I think you know quite a lot about this as well, Alex, probably wouldn't consider them collaborative, open, you know, inspired by nature. So to actually see fintechs coming through and acting a bit like this is really inspiring. And one business in particular is a fintech that is designed to create a journey for people not typically served by the financial by financial products, to a journey to wealth and wealth generation and savings building, but also then being able to make choices aligned to their values with what they do with that wealth generation when they've got it. And this business is working in a new way. It's working very collaboratively. It's reaching out to not just other fintechs and retail banking fintechs. It's reaching out beyond that and saying, how can we work with mental health charities? How can we work with food poverty sector? How can we work with traditional retail banks and share the data that we've got about why they're excluding these people from even being able to get a foot on the ladder? And then when they hire people, they're hiring people and asking them, well, what else do you want to do? How do you want to, what do you want to add to this product right now? And really creating like an ecosystem of users internally of their product, but also users externally. And I think it's really paid off because they launched last August, completely organically. So they had no spend to launch their new app. And they've already got 11,500 active users, which doing organically, really engage users and a community around a product. And if you know anything about wanting to create communities around a product, traditionally what people do is go, right, I want a community because I want all of that community to sign up to my app and download it and use it and I'll make money out of them. This community is designed to really inform what the product is for them. And this community is thriving again, created organically. And that's really interesting to see this blur between charities, between experts in certain things like food poverty, what's led to that, why don't they have money, to big retail banks, to this in the middle of it, this relatively small startup working and operating with a completely different mindset. And the only way I can describe it is they've created a little mycelium network like fungi does to really serve the forest.
Amazing. And can you share the name of the startup?
Yes, I can. It's called Your Juno.
Your Juno.
Yes. So okay. There is another one as well that's very similar called Claro. So Your Juno, their particular audience is women and non-binary people, and Claro Money, their audience is anyone but typically those underserved by traditional banks.
Beautiful examples, you know, really, really nice to hear about them. I think this resonates in particular because, you know, this is something that shaped Catalyst Ventures. And over the last 5 to 10 years, we've just seen so much more of an uptick in entrepreneurs who are not just going out there to make money, but want to have a positive impact as well. And this has really shaped our whole triple top line thinking in terms of, you know, can we really encourage startups that are, you know, essentially functioning like mycelium networks, as you say, that are having this positive impact on people, planet, and profit. So, yeah. So this is a really nice one. And then linking that back to the original question around employee engagement.
Yeah.
It's kind of so obvious, right? It's so much more rewarding and fulfilling to work for an organization that's having this impact and not just, hey, I work for someone and they make money and I get a salary. So yes. this is a really, really important, sense in my mind.
I think as well, definitely it's around having a role in an organization that is more than profit. That is incredibly important. And it's not generational. Lots of people say it's generational, that Gen Zs, etc., Gen Zs, whatever you want to call them, want to work for a purpose-driven business, want to work with a business that gives back. I'm seeing it across generations, which is really, really great. And I'd say for big corporates, there is another element of it's almost helping employer. I do a lot of work with corporates, have done in the past as well, and there's pilots with the corporate. Actually, right now, it's about those corporates understanding they have to genuinely engage with what their employees want from a role and from the impact that big company has, because they are more than aware that that the larger the business, the larger the impact it's likely to have and the influence on its customers, not just the impact on the planet, the impact on economies, impact on things like how it acts in a global pandemic, what it does with employee data, what it does with customer data, but also on the products and services it encourages its customers to buy, that organizations need to take it seriously that their employees now care more than they've cared in the past for lots of reasons, including the fact we've just had a global pandemic, which has connected us as humans. So with them, even with the example I gave you with the 15 minutes for the future, it's about saying to them, it is not good enough doing an e-learning course and making it a compulsory part of your CPD, that your workforce takes that self-serve e-learning course that describes the key concepts and scientific facts and figures around the climate emergency, because your employees will see this as a tick box exercise. And also, at worst, at best, they do the course and learn something, but then they go into a sense of hopelessness and helplessness because you haven't set them up with the permission, the confidence and competence to do something next about it. So therefore, your role as an organization is to lead in providing the conditions for your employees and your customers to act.
Some really, really important words, and I think some great takeaways as well for the audience listening in on this. So thanks for sharing that, Erica. I guess we're coming to sort of the end of time. I could happily go on all day here, but to sort of to summarize back to where we've covered, you know, finishing up here with sort of employees, with business models, with sort of thinking about the future, all the way from the start, from the internal transformation, personal behavioral change to wider groups and so on. I think you've sort of, touched and leaned towards this sense of hope as something that I think is really, really important throughout. So maybe we could sort of finish on a high note and hear something from you around hope for the future, for the coming years.
I will link it back to businesses as well. I'm also seeing, which I'm really hopeful about, and seeing businesses moving beyond thinking about their near-term strategy, their near-term profit, their near-term solutions for growth, and thinking beyond that, thinking, you know, almost 5, 10, 20, 30, 50 years in advance. And that's really great because that gives you the framework to think about the impact you're going to have in the long term. And that could be dangerous because it could be, well, we don't need to do anything now. But I've got this motto that I'm seeing people, and especially the people I work with and have been delivering these impact at scale workshops with, and just seeing what they're already doing and coming back with. And that's think big, but the next hour matters. And I'm seeing people do that, and I'm seeing people naturally start doing it. And I think maybe this is me just being a really positive, hopeful person, but I think what's come out of a pandemic is individual business and business level belief. You can change, and you can change quickly, and you're not going to fall over and die doing it. And that's why people are doing this. Think big, but the next hour matters.
Fantastic. Erica, I'm right behind you on that. I think that's that gives us enormous cause for hope for the future. And that's a brilliant way to wrap up today. So thank you very much for joining us. It's been a true pleasure to talk and hear so many ideas, insights, but also, you know, so many concrete actions and things that they're working on. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The future is triple top line. Thank you.